I love the little bit. This is a sidebar where they're talking about all the ships leaving. Is like Bayonne gone, Staten Island gone. Thank God. It's like, ow, that one hurt.
I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Never fear change. Life is too short for fear. Chase what is desired.
I can do this all day.
Would you mind identifying what you are?
We're the best friend squad.
That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team.
Welcome to the rodeo. Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride.
This is the way.
I have spoken.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Song, you know the difference between you and me? You make this look good.
It's still good. It's a good one. I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And we're here today to talk about Men in Black. Thank you, Paul, for coming on for this one, because I think we're about to have a lot of fun.
I think so. I had to dig this DVD out of my giant pile of DVDs, and I was glad you got me to do that.
Excellent. So, quick, before we get into general reactions and summarizing this film and spoiler walls and all that, I just want to make a quick announcement regarding Capricorn, the convention typically held in Chicago every year in February. This coming year will be virtual. I will put some links up in the show notes for this episode, but basically they're looking for participants. They're looking for panel ideas, fully fledged, all of that. We want to build the best conventions that we possibly can. The theme for this year is creating the future that we want. It features some pretty astonishing guests of honor, including our very own Brandon O'Brien. Nice. Elliot the Bodard will be here, Michi Troda. There'll be a bunch of other fantastic folks. I do recommend going to the website. That'll be linked also in the show notes. But please, if you have a panel idea that you think would just be super cool to see at this convention, we want those ideas. If you have dream panelists for those, awesome. Send it in to us. Links will be in the description. So hopefully everybody will come and check it out. I'm really hoping it's going to be another stellar convention that everybody will be talking about for, you know, as long as we're talking about conventions.
Word. I'll have to check it out myself.
Absolutely. So we're here to talk about Men in Black, which means we got to get to a summary of what Men in Black is about, just in case there's people listening to this who've never seen it.
And since I do 5-minute long, 2-detailed summaries, Sean's going to do this one.
Sure. And I think the premise of Men in Black is a pretty simple premise, but it's one that has lots of fun complexities. This film follows primarily the character of Jay, who is a up-and-coming NYPD officer who gets pulled into the sort of web of this secretive organization called the Men in Black. His primary contact for this is Tommy Lee Jones, who sort of brings him into it. He needs to be inducted into a world of aliens and all of these kinds of things. And that's the basic setup for this. He gets brought in, he gets picked to be part of this organization, and shenanigans ensue, as you can imagine. This is Will Smith in his heyday. This is like the Will Smith era. Great films like Independence Day are from the same period. There's lots of jokes, there's lots of fun and excitement, there's alien goo, all kinds of really exciting things, big guns, etc. If you've seen the posters or the previews for this, you kind of get the same idea that I've just given you. It is a fantastic and fun and exciting film that spawned 2 sequels and an attempted reboot.
It did indeed, and also has a wealth of actors besides Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. It has Linda Fiorentino, it has Vincent D'Onofrio, it's got Rip Torn,
yep.
It's got lots of small roles for other actors. It's a cavalcade of people really enjoying themselves on the screen. The film loves its physical comedy hard, and it also loves its social comedy almost as much.
Absolutely. It really has a lot of fun, which I think is really important, because this film can go one of two ways. It can be super slapsticky, or it can be very, very serious, and it, I think, threads the needle very nicely between those two.
I mean, especially once the pairing of the opening sequence with Kay's partner being retired and the ending kind of bookend the movie. And that, what Kay's been doing with Jay all along, is revealed in that last bit. And it is heartwarming and touching.
Why don't we give our quick general reactions, and then we'll get into spoiler territory where we'll just lay all of the thoughts out. And so I'll let you give your general reaction first, Paul, given that it's probably been a little bit since you last saw this.
I mean, yes, I have had this DVD on the pile, but I had to go digging for it because it wasn't a movie I'd rewatch again and again. But as I rewatched this, I wondered, well, why haven't I rewatched this again and again? That was a suboptimal choice. The movie is fun. It's fast. It's light with enough social commentary to thoughtfulness to keep it grounded and not be a complete confection. It's got great acting, great sequences, great chemistry between the reads, especially Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. I mean, I'm gonna pretend that Men in Black 2 didn't really exist because it didn't do that great, and for reasons maybe we'll discuss later. I wish Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith had done more movies together because they clearly work very well off each other. And that's kind of how this movie goes. I mean, all the leads bounce off each other very nicely.
I mean, this is a thing, you know, part of my general reaction is obviously about the fact that Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith really, really feed off each other very well. You know, Tommy Lee Jones kind of has gotten a little bit of criticism for being a bit curmudgeonly because this same era is Tommy Lee Jones playing Two-Face alongside Jim Carrey's Riddler, and is notorious for having basically told Jim Carrey that he didn't appreciate his shenanigans. But this, it feels like they actually did enjoy working alongside each other, which I think is part of what makes this film so really enjoyable, is that you have a very clear, the sort of young, high energy Will Smith, who is comedic and sarcastic and all of this, against a very straight man style Tommy Lee Jones. And it plays so well from start to finish that you really buy into their story right the second they really meet each other. And then the payoff at the end is actually, I think, like what you said, it's heartwarming. And so I, like you, I've probably seen this more times than you have in recent years. But going back to this, it was a reminder of why buying the DVD when it first came out and I managed to get a hold of it was totally worth every dollar, because this film is fantastic and a lot of fun, and I would argue even more so holds up.
Yeah, I think it does hold up. I mean, we get actual character arcs and development. I mean, yeah, Will Smith is the young newbie who learns on the job, but the opening scene has Kay and his coming to an end with his partner at the end. We have Kay basically passing the baton on to Jay and wanting to go back to the quote-unquote normal life. And it's even evoked with the same words, like, you ever look at the stars. It's like, and that's a metaphor and a guiding principle throughout this entire movie. It's like the whole chase thing is about a galaxy contained inside of a jewel. And what's the endings? Ending scene we see our own galaxy is itself inside of a marble in some alien's bag, and it's the movie goes through other messages as well. I'm gonna go just dive into it. The sequence with quote unquote illegal aliens, air quotes, and how the movie back then. I mean, nowadays that scene might come in for criticism among certain members of the political establishment for being so welcoming of aliens. I mean, but Kay doesn't care. He only cared about the interplanetary alien, the quote-unquote illegal aliens from Mexico. He welcomes them to the United States straight off. And that's a message that we could use today. And even the alien that he unmasks, he's not demonizing. It's only when things go south that he actually has to kill him. There's a reluctance to use that violence. Unless it's absolutely necessary, and only in the most direst of circumstances, A, with that alien, B, of course, with the bug, as played by Vincent D'Onofrio, they don't necessarily want to kill him. They just want to keep him from destroying the galaxy in an interstellar war.
Yeah, and I, to add to this, there's a great sequence where Kay is explaining to the person who eventually becomes Jay, Edwards is his original name, and he's explaining to him, like any given time, there's a certain number of aliens on Earth. And, most of them are just like decent folk. They just want to make a living and they just go about their lives doing their thing. And he says that, like, it's not a big deal. Like, they're just people. And they're just people that, like, have extra limbs or look like a slug person, like all of this. They're just different people. And so there's this, like, message of, like, from Kay's perspective, his only job is making sure that the Earth is safe. And it's not just for humanity, it's for anybody who calls Earth home, including himself. And so when we do see him sort of being rougher with some of the aliens that they meet, like, we have a lot of different contrasting pictures of that. There is the sequence when they go and try to figure out why the man with his pregnant wife is trying to leave. They turn out to also be aliens, and they're leaving the world. And instead of having that be like, I'm going to arrest you, this is all bad news, it's all very kind of compassionate. Also funny, because Will Smith has to basically birth a giant squid creature.
And getting beat up by the woman's tentacles. And we see that in the background as Kay is talking to Reggie. And it's just hilarious.
Yeah. You know, there's this lovely contrast that, you know, on the one hand, Kay is, yes, he is, you know, a G-man of sorts. He is essentially an interstellar police officer on Earth or something to that effect. And so he's doing all of these things where it's like there's laws and he'd be following, blah, 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 blah. And so sometimes it's sort of like bad cop kind of roughing it up kind of thing. And so they've got the flashy thing, which everybody, the neuralizer that takes away memories. But on the other hand, he's got this deep compassion for the people that are just people going through people problems, right? This guy, Reggie, is just trying to save his kid, his wife. He's trying to save his family from what he thinks is certain doom. And that's his only idea, is like, I want to protect my family. And it's Kay's response to that is not like, oh no, you just got to stay here and suck it up like the rest of us. No, it's like, I totally get where you're coming from. I can kind of respect it. You know, congratulations on having your squid baby.
Like, congratulations, Reggie. It's a squid.
It's a squid. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of that. Like, there is the, you know, this undercurrent of a sort of serious narrative at work here that it wants to tease out those things. I mean, certainly you can make an argument that it doesn't successfully do all angles of it. And I would say that there are some aspects of this film that don't translate as well to, you know, 2020 audience. So there's some fat jokes that I think,
yeah,
kind of fall a little flat now. I almost said fall a little flat. Oops. And that, yeah, anyway. But, you know, overall, I think like the story is so effective at what it is and what it wants to explore through these two characters. And I think that's part of what makes it just so much fun to watch, is it's not trying to make its point too hard, and it's not trying to be more than it needs to be, right? Its action set pieces are pretty small, you know, in the grand scheme, right? It relies on CG very specific moments. It doesn't excessively focus on those elements. It wants this to be a story about people, mm-hmm. You know, funny people, I will say. You know, Will Smith is pretty darn hilarious in this, and there's lots of little jokes and bits, but it's very much a story about people. And for the kind of thing that you were mentioning about the marbles, right, this like element that comes at the very end, this idea of, you know, us being this blip in a universe of universes, right, a marble in a bag of marbles. This gives a sense of this grand scale, but like the story of almost every Men in Black story is like that grand scale isn't really like present on Earth. It's this thing that goes on in this background, and it's all very focused on like people trying to solve these problems in this one space at this one time so that life can keep going.
And keep most people relatively unaware of it. I mean, because K.O. Pornboy says there's always someone in Terran Battlefleet or Interstellar Plague or Death Weapon pointed at Earth, and how do people get along? They don't know about it. It's just like, and that's their job, is to keep people relatively firewalled from all this interstellar stuff, and just so they can they and the aliens who live here can live their lives peacefully. As K says, Casablanca, but no Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, there's a little hint of cynicism here, because earlier on he basically says that people, a person is smart, but people are dumb, panicky, you know, make all, you know, those kinds, right, of things, and everybody kind of knows it. So there's a little bit of that cynicism about people, but also we kind of get it. Like, it's not wrong. This is 1990s America. This is a handful of years, 1997, roughly 4 years before 9/11. So
this is, I mean, this is a movie of its time, and maybe we haven't seen Men in Black International, and maybe we will for a future event, but this is a movie that's set, as I like to say, between the fall of the wall and the fall of the towers. And at that point, America was, for all intents and purposes, the only superpower, and it was a very different and almost much more optimistic world. I mean, there was all sorts of things happening that we weren't aware of, and and things percolating to the surface that eventually would come to our grief, example 9/11. But at that time, it looked like it was a shining moment for America because China was still trying to build itself up. Russia was a shambles, and the rest of the world looked to us. So it was a unipolar, relatively straightforward looking world. Even if you stepped outside the boundaries of the United States, you learned quickly that was not the case. But it seemed that way. And that's almost like the movie's almost like metaphoring the 90s at the time. Like, oh yeah, everything looks fine and great on the surface, and that's what we want people to see, even if the reality is much more complex. But there was a moment of quiet stillness, at least outwardly, for most people that, yeah, I mean, if Men in Black was filmed. And now, as I recall, Men in Black 2 was going to be released in 2001, and 9/11 kind of blew that up, and they cut the movie to ribbons. And as a result, Men in Black 2 is a 75-minute piece of mess. But I don't think the original Men in Black could have been filmed after 9/11. You agree or disagree? This movie as we have it here.
Men in Black 2 is 2002. It's roughly this July 3rd. So Men in Black 1 comes out July 2nd, 1997. The other one comes out July 3rd. It comes out in a time, you know, roughly 6, 7, 8 months, or 9 months. I'm not sure exactly. Math in my head. I think that you could still tell this story in a post-9/11 world, but I think that it makes the story more complex than I think they. To me, the Men in Black series wants to be tied into the real world only a little bit. It just wants to have a slight anchor into the real, but it doesn't necessarily want the problems that it's dealing with to actually be fully anchored into real world issues. Mm-hmm. It wants to use metaphor to talk about those issues, but it doesn't want to feel anchored to the real issue that it's a metaphor about. So like this film is about immigration, and in a lot of respects, it's about immigration. Aside from having an opening sequence that clearly is talking about illegal immigration to the U.S., which is clearly a big issue in the 90s and still is, it doesn't really go back to those issues. It sort of deals with metaphor through the aliens, whereas Men in Black 2 is dealing with, you know, big threats to the world from essentially an alien terrorist. I mean, that's effectively what that film is about. Mm-hmm. And it comes out in 2002, and so it has a sort of like connection to 9/11 in a sense, because there's that sort of terroristic angle. But to me, the film still wants to like feel like it exists in a world where 9/11 didn't happen. And that, I think, is part of its problem. You could do that story, but I think that Barry Sonnenfeld and some of the writers don't want the story to be too tied to the real. And I'll say it this way. The way that makes it most clear to me that they don't is the way that they deal with the news in this film, which is when they go, Kate goes to find, you know, evidence, you know, let's check the papers, right? What all of us are expecting is he's going to go look at the New York Times, a Weipo, all of those like big newspapers, Chicago Tribune, all that. But no, what is he going for? It's all the tabloids. It's the place where like Batboy would have been on the cover. And so there's this sense of like deep irony and hilarity about how the news really works in a world where aliens exist. The problem is that Men in Black 2, the things that are in those papers after 9/11 are not things that really can work, because they would be stories about like aliens did 9/11 or it was a secret inside job. And if we're going to take this world seriously, in the sense that the tabloid is the place where you find the quote unquote real news about aliens and all of that stuff, you can't still do that in a post 9/11 world and not be, I think, arguably pretty offensive. So you'd have to do it in a very unique way that I think they just punted on and decided not to bother trying.
Are you familiar with the wrestling term kayfab?
No, please explain.
Okay. I use this a lot, especially in relation to the current occupant of the White House, who, as you will remember, once did participate in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Kayfabe is the idea of not breaking the illusion that what happens in the wrestling shows and the wrestling ring is real. It's basically playing that to the hilt, of basically accepting that as reality, as an alternate reality, and not escaping it. It's like, so when the announcers see an injury or some sort of some sort of scripted event. They take it perfectly straight as if, yep, that's really what's happening and not break it. And so when things go really strangely wrong in a wrestling ring, like when someone gets really hurt or when a storyline goes completely unexpected, the quote unquote Montreal Screwjob, which some of our listeners and some of our friends will know all about because they're wrestling fans. My point for this is the Weekly World News and all those other tabloids from the 90s, especially the not necessarily the Inquirer, the ones about like aliens and Bigfoot and everything else, there's a kayfabe to that where they actually seem, at least provide an illusion of believing this stuff, even though clearly the writers and most of the readers don't, but there's a consistency within those tabloids of a kayfabe of, oh yeah, the world's full of cryptids and aliens and all this stuff, and that's the secret world, and you are inducted into that, even if intellectually, I'm sure most of the readers didn't believe that stuff. I mean, my mother, rest in peace, bought these things all the time, and she knew they weren't real. She knew Batboy and stuff, but she enjoyed the kayfabe of that kind of illusion. She also was a wrestling fan, so there you go. So it's almost like a shared alternate reality. Men in Black, especially by tying into those tabloids, uses that kayfabe of the 90s in a way that, as you said, after 9/11, that kayfabe is shattered and broken. And 9/11, in a sense, broke a lot of things as far as that sort of perception and worldview in favor of a much harsher and darker one. It doesn't have that foundation now to try to do that again because nobody seriously cares about Bigfoot or aliens. It's conspiracies and dark stuff and QAnon. I mean, that's colonized that space, and that's a much darker kayfabe. And unfortunately, in that case, people are believing it for real.
Yeah, and I think that you're onto something here that you know is why this works in the context of this film, right? 1997. You know, the stuff that were even shown on screen is like, you know, oh, like someone took, you know, was wearing my husband's skin, which ties directly into what happens to Edgar, who is played by Vincent D'Onofrio, who gets taken over by the alien, the bug. You know, there are these images, but like there's this sense of like almost like we can be disconnected just enough. Like, oh, like this idea that this alien is wearing human skin or like aliens exist as a story about crop circles. Like those aren't part of some nefarious evil thing, right? There are these incidences that are strange and unusual, and if they were true, could potentially have earth-shattering consequences of our perception of our place in the universe, but if true, don't have a lot of very deep personal stakes for us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the kinds of stuff that comes in the post 9/11 world do have very serious personal stakes. If something like 9/11 was an inside job is true, that has dramatic consequences for any American watching this film, and certainly for people's watching elsewhere. I mean, if someone's watching that Men in Black 2 and that were presented as, you know, like the tabloids were presented with those things and it dealt with 9/11, right? In the event that something like that conspiracy turned out to be true, even people from countries that had been fucking invaded by the United States, that would have dramatic consequences. So the consequences are not big, wide, like existential consequences. They're like consequences of on the scale of like mass murder and crimes against humanity and total destruction of our relationship to other people and our society. Whereas like, you know, if Batboy turns out to be real, it's just like, okay, so there's a dude who's like a half bat. And like, yeah, it changes our understanding of genetics, but like there's one Batboy. It doesn't have dramatic consequences for the entire world. Or, you know, the fact that the bugs are real in this film, you know, for you even see this, right? Because Agent J, right, when he eventually joins this organization, he has one moment that I think is really great in this film where he contemplates the consequences of sacrificing his relationship to any family he might have because he has to get, he can't have that anymore. But but once they get past that, the only thing that's really at stake for him is like the things that he thought were true about people are just a little bit not as true anymore. He's always known, right? With this third grade teacher or whatever, that one moment where he's saying, like, I always knew there was something off.
Yep.
Like, I always thought she was from Venus or something. And literally Kay goes, well, she's like from Jupiter or one of the moons. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, there's this sense of like the thing that's being uprooted for Agent J is minor, even though it would seem like this big deal. It's like aliens are real. That seems really big. But I think compared to like the kinds of things that could have, you know, like destroy democracies, the scale of the damage for the individual just feels, it's harder to escape than the sort of fantasy of aliens being real and being among us and those kinds of things. And I think that's part of why Men in Black 1 works so effectively, is it's just having fun with this idea.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need to be so serious that like it wants to actually deal with like the philosophical ramifications. That's not really its interest. It's trying to tell a different type of story. And I think what Men in Black does is it's trying to do the same kind of thing, but it exists in a time, in a post 9/11 time, in which that thing doesn't quite work the same as it did the first time around in 1997, when, as you said, things seemed to be on the up for at least in America. I can't say that for the rest of the world, per se.
Right.
But things seemed to be going up, quote unquote. Things seemed to be improving and getting better, and life was moving in a good direction, quote unquote. You know,
I mean, the quote, end of history had been declared.
Right. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Fukuyama and all of them.
It's like, yeah, how wrong he was, how wrong we all were at that time.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, that there is that sense of optimism that exists in a lot of films like this. I mean, even Independence Day, in a way that this film doesn't, because Independence Day is very rooted in like American mythology about how...
Right from the title, and right from how people are looking around the world, looking to America to solve the problem, which...
Precisely.
I mean, at that time, yeah, makes sense. Now it feels really jingoistic and unipolar in a way that really doesn't reflect reality. I mean, now it feels tone deaf. Then it felt like, oh yeah, of course America's leading. America's the greatest country on earth. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wonder if on some level this is part of what like Men in Black International wants to get to. Because Men in Black is, you know, yes, on the one hand it's not supposed to be America and Americanized, but it is. I mean,
most of them in the vicinity of Manhattan. I mean, if you freeze and look and see all those people that we see on the image who are really aliens, they're all Americans. Sylvester Stallone, Newt Gingrich.
Al Roker. Yeah.
Al Roker. Like, they're all, you don't see any really identifiable international people in that thing. And I mean, from a logistics point of view, you basically do want most aliens in and around Manhattan just for ease of control. And there's that the whole thing with the alien, that it's like apparently some aliens can leave Manhattan and some can't. This is restrictions on where you can actually settle in the world. And not to mention, I mean, the whole opening sequence, the guy's trying to sneak across the border. So it has a very Americanized focus, because, you know, America is the one true country of which all others are but shadows. And that makes me think of The Truman Show, where you have this guy stuck in this fake town, but everything is arranged to try to keep him in that town. And we're really going far afield from this movie. But the one point where one of his friends hands him the paper and the title is "Who Needs Europe?" is the title on that paper, because he's like, it's just basically trying to reinforce the idea that, like, yeah, America, or in that case, small town America, is what it's all about, and the rest of the world can go hang. And between the fall of the wall and the fall of the towers, that's kind of how America felt about things and how we projected ourselves to the world in Independence Day much strongly, and here implicitly in Men in Black.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Like, we're talking, you know, about the 90s, really, of especially science fiction cinema, and there's just a very clear sense that a lot of the science fiction cinema of that period is, if not explicitly pro-American, at least by implication pro-American. I mean, Men in Black, I would say, is more by implication being pro-American. I mean, it's not trying to come out and have Tommy Lee Jones go like, America's the greatest, right? Or any of these kinds of things. But it, because of its setting, because of where it's placed, because of the people that it centers on, because of the narratives of immigration, I mean... The fact of the matter is they chose New York as the place to go. That is from the history of the U.S. and its mythologies of immigration. That is one of the centralized places from which, you know, we'll take your huddled masses, literally on the Statue of Liberty, all of that right smack in this area, which you know, because you're originally from, you're from Staten Island, as I recall.
As I am. And I love the little bit, this is a sidebar, where they're talking about all the ships leaving, like Bayonne gone, Staten Island, gone, thank God. It's like, ow, that one hurt.
Part of why I think this film probably for a lot of people is going to hold up in a way that some of the other films of the same era is precisely because even though it's centralized in American spaces and all pretty much every character in the film with a couple of exceptions are Americans and is dealing with issues that are at least relevant in America specifically, you know, it's still a film that's about, you know, people and about, you know, lives and people living in a deeply international city. There are people in this film that are presented in New York because New York is a reasonably multicultural space. You know, you've got cab drivers from different parts of the world. You've got all these kinds of different people. So there's this sense of there is a larger world and we're not trying to contain the world everywhere. You know, we're trying to contain it into a single unified American perception of the world. And I think that's part of what makes this film really a lot of fun is you can kind of escape that a bit from that same period. You don't have to think about it as much. You can just sort of have this fun idea of like, well, what would happen if aliens showed up on Earth and Roswell, right, which we learn in, I believe, the second film, Roswell turned out to be a real event in which aliens came down. Well, okay, cool. So we'll bring in aliens and New York is just a logical place because so many people from all over the globe go to New York. It's a place where there's so much of that internationalness in New York. And that's not to suggest maybe in Men in Black International does this, is to say, but there are also Men in Black organizations elsewhere because other major cities like London or Brisbane or something like that are also doing the same thing. So there's this idea of like all these multicultural spaces around the world become havens for aliens to come to Earth to eke out their own sort of living in a human world. I like the idea. I think it's cool. I mean, I would say that this film is not dealing with this in like a lot of detail.
No, it's shoved very, very back in the forehead. But one little tiny bit of dialogue when Kay is telling Jay about the aliens and Jay says cab drivers, and what does Kay say? Not as many as you think. Saying right. Yes, those are real humans, not all aliens. Thank you very much. That was a nice little bit of like, yes, there's plenty of people from around the world who are cab drivers. They're not all aliens. So it was almost like a little bit of a take that pushback against that sort of idea. And I like that.
Yeah, there is a sense that the film does sometimes want to push back against assumptions that Americans in particular would probably have about immigrants. It doesn't push hard, I would say, but it does offer little snippets of pushback. And I do appreciate that this film does that. I mean, to me, the only sequence of jokes that I can think of that really don't work here is really just the sequence of jokes with the fat jokes at the beginning, which we understand because he's this guy who is incredibly athletic and he's up with a bunch of his fellow officers who just aren't as athletic. And the joke is supposed to be like he chased down this cephalopod, this alien who is, you know, super athletic, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what makes mm-hmm. him so desirable as a candidate for the MIB. But I think like the joke just goes a bit too far. It becomes a little bit too mean.
Yeah, it's very much, unfortunately, the standards of humor at that time. It wouldn't fly today. It would probably get cut off, and deservedly so.
But I mean, I will say that it's only the beginning that it does this, and then it sort of discards them.
And that's also a very, I mean, and also now I'm thinking about it, that sort of best of the best, the NYPD is something that might be much more examined much more harshly today than was back then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone through a lot with police violence, brutality, and racism. And this movie doesn't even think about that.
Oh, it does though. It does. There's a scene where they do kind of deal with this, maybe not as explicitly as we would expect today, but it does definitely deal with it. And that is the scene when Edwards goes in, he doesn't know what he's there for, but he's going into the MIB facility to basically be tested on whether or not he's going to go.
Right.
And there's the scene when they are supposed to do a shooting test.
Oh, yes. That's hilarious.
And it's hilarious because he's up against a bunch of military guys and their immediate instinct is monstrous looking creatures. Shoot them all immediately. Kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them. And what I think is interesting about the scene is that Edwards or future Jay, his decision is he's going to shoot this little white girl with the quantum physics books. And when he's asked why he decided she had to die, the reasons he gives are actually really interesting. They're funny, But it's basically like he looks at all the other monsters and he looks at the context of what's happening for each and every single one of them. And he's basically saying, like, you know, I don't want to kill that guy because he's at the gym. That guy's sneezing. Why would I want to kill the guy that's sneezing? Right. And then he says, but she's like out in this like kind of dank neighborhood with quantum physics books by herself. And she's a little girl, like, that of the people there, the one that's suspicious is her, the white girl.
Yes.
And I think what's happening there is that there's an element of Will Smith's character is meant to be an officer who actually believes in the idea, like, I am serving a purpose here, and I'm fulfilling that purpose to the maximum of my ability. But my purpose is not just upholding the law for the sake of upholding the law, right? Context matters to what I'm doing. And I think that scene is supposed to show that. It's showing it through a joke, and it is funny. It's a hilarious sequence. But I think it shows such a direct contrast between him and all the military guys, and why when I watched the entire sequence of him becoming eventually an MIB guy, why it makes sense for him to get picked over everyone else, because all of them are follow orders, do what you're told, shoot, 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 ask questions later. And he is the one that goes, I don't know why I'm here. We still don't know why we're here. Could someone give me answers? I'm going to make, you know, decisions based on the context of the situation. So I'm not going to use the seats as the way that I'm going to take my test. I'm going to move this table to take care of it. I'm going to analyze the situation of the people that are in this sequence where I'm supposed to shoot stuff. And I'm going to make decisions based on who gets shot, determine, you know, as a determination of like their threat level, right? There's this sense of like there's a thought process to everything he's doing. It is not follow orders. And I think it makes sense totally why he gets picked because of that sequence.
Yeah, but the two sequences together. First, he's willing to think outside the box to move the table, whereas all the others are poking holes through the paper and struggling. He's the one that actually thinks to actually do something different rather than what was told. And then, yeah, the shooting sequence where he doesn't shoot at anything till he's not entirely sure he did the right thing. It's like, unless I have to make an apology, I believe is what he says at the end to the little girl. Yeah. Like, and we saw already he was observant from the beginning that, I mean, he saw the two eyes of the alien, and that threw him off, and he had to get neuralized. And throughout the movie, he's not the follow orders type, and Zed points that out, like, he has a problem with authority, but he's an intelligent protagonist, not a rah-rah dumb one. I mean, he's inexperienced, but he's not dumb.
Right, it's like, for him, the situation, the context of his situation is the thing that determines the appropriate action. And while that does create problems for him later, right, when he gets the noisy cricket, another one of those funny scenes where you give him this tiny little gun, not realizing it's actually really powerful, right, he doesn't stop to think, alien who's about to destroy the Earth, I can't discharge this firearm in public because it's weaponry that shouldn't exist. He just gung-ho, context says, stop the alien, he's going to destroy the entire Earth, bad, bad, bad. So there's a sense of, like, the context is what determines anything he does.
And consider how he solves the problem of stopping the alien from getting into the second ship at the end. He starts smashing the bugs to distract the alien. He can't beat him physically. He can't hold him down. He sees little bugs and he figures that's the way to basically distract the alien from getting on the ship, kill the other bugs. Jay doesn't beat him physically. He beats him psychologically by basically tricking him.
Yeah, and I will just note for folks who may be concerned, no actual bugs were harmed in the production of this film. They used mustard packets, apparently, to mimic him squashing the bugs. So that was a concern for me, as there have been a number of films that, like, bugs are the acceptable thing that you smash, and I'm not really personally terribly comfortable with that, of just killing a bunch of bugs because you need to have a sequence for that. So this film doesn't do that. It actually uses some visual trickery to make it seem like he's actually doing it, but they're using mustard packets, which I think is pretty cool. What's interesting too about this is that, you know, we're talking about the bugs now, this alien race of bugs. They're basically giant cockroaches, kind of, or more like kind of giant ants, I think, a little bit more accurately, more ant-like. But what's interesting about them is that the MIB response is, initially, it's not actually destroy, capture. I think you'd mentioned this before, capture, you know, maybe send them off world, imprison them, whatever. Like, initially,
get the galaxy back, yeah.
Get the galaxy back, stop it. But it's only at the end, when basically they've got no choice, right? The bug's given them no options now. They have to destroy it. There's just no choice now because the bug swallowed it, and also the bug is not willingly giving in at all. And so there's this like sense here that once we get into the MIB, you know, it's unlike what we might say. It's sort of optimistic. It's unlike what we might expect of, like, you know, what would happen with Edwards if he stayed in the NYPD, which is like, we know what the consequence of this is because we're living in an era when there's increasing police awareness of what police do, which is, you know, oftentimes violate people's rights and hurt them, etc. But in this, like, the MIB has this optimistic role of like, we are a police force, but we're not a police force that is there to, we're only protecting because we're trying to protect the world from knowing about you guys. So we want you to be able to live your lives. So our primary purpose is policing and monitoring, but only in a very specific set of contexts. And we only use lethal force when it comes to things that we absolutely have to, like protecting the entire world from being blown up by a bug man. That, like, we have, there's no choice there. But, like, when their interaction with the other aliens, like when they meet Mikey at the beginning, right? It's like, well, you're in prison. He's done bad things. And they don't want to kill him, but they don't have any choice because he's about to kill another man.
Yeah.
You know, or they meet Reggie and it's like, we don't want to hurt you. We actually want to figure out why are you leaving? Why are you in such a rush? What do you know? You know, and they don't actually send him back. They basically let him go. That happens all throughout this. Like, the one that they're the meanest to is Frank the dog, because he shakes this poor pug.
Yeah. Again, mistaken expectations. I mean, we see the pug and we see this this monster like figure next to him, and Jay's obviously thinking that that's the alien, and no, it's actually the pug.
Right. Yeah. And this is, I think it's really great, which is because Jay's such a new character, and you have Tommy Lee Jones, who's like the clear veteran, right from the beginning. He's so veteran, right? He knows exactly what he's doing, knows how the game works, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have just these brilliant moments where, like, you know, he's playing this straight man against a guy who literally doesn't know anything. He's just like going off of his instincts, and his instincts are sometimes flat out wrong.
Right. He says, all your skills mean exactly dick is what he says when he brings him into the main room for the first time. And it's
precisely.
Jay has a lot to learn before he can become an agent. And that's kind of like the whole point. You can't just like pick up this job. You have to be trained for it. And yet that, as we learn through the movie, that K himself was, and because they said seven agents, one astronomer, and one poor kid who got lost. Turns out he's the poor kid.
Yeah.
That's the irony. Like, he wasn't the trained agent at all. He was a lucky person to have to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, everything you're saying was spot on, but I do want to make sure that we have a little bit of time to talk about. We've talked about J and K and Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, but the one thing that we've not talked about at all is Vincent D'Onofrio in this.
I just want to touch on, I was a little disappointed at the relatively smallness of Linda Fiorentino's role. Yes, it's funny at the end that she shoots the alien, but otherwise she gets a little short shrift, which disappoints me. I think in a more modern, or if there's ever to reboot this again, I think I'd prefer that she have a better role, because she's much more of just only a plot element in this movie, and that's a little disappointing, but again, that's unfortunately very 90s. But let's go to Vincent D'Onofrio, who just inhabits the Edgar suit. He's put on this Edgar character bug suit and just goes for it. He's got lots of physical comedy, lots of fun with his accent. I mean, his speech patterns from the sugar in water.
To his
interactions with Jay, with Jay particularly, and it's just like physically waltzing, like grabbing the plates of pierogies and dropping them in front of the aliens that he's going to kill. It's like he's such a joy of an actor to actually just see him just play with this role, and you forget that it's him as an actor, and you're just like totally absorbed with the. With the character of the bug inside the Edgar suit, that you don't even think it's him.
Yeah, I mean, the thing here that I think becomes, you know, what's interesting about the character, Edgar, like, the second we meet him, we don't like him. And so we don't feel bad about him getting, you know, hollowed out and his skin used by an alien bug creature at
it's,
all.
It's unfortunately not much of a downgrade.
Yeah, it's really not. Yeah. But then, like, this other thing that really comes out here is, like, the you mentioned the physicality of the character. You know, Vincent D'Onofrio really puts a lot of effort into the movements and his exaggerated, you know, twitchiness, because this idea is like this, it's a giant insect. And when we see the insect at the end, we realize how big it is. It's a giant insect inside this tiny suit. So it's actually deeply uncomfortable for him to be in human form, like really badly.
And then the body is decaying and not in the greatest of shape. His head is crooked.
Yep.
And I don't know if they did it with the prosthetics or he just kinked his head for most of the shots, but it must have been deeply uncomfortable for him as an actor to do that.
But he seems to like have a lot of fun with just these twitchy motions, you know, doing the talk to the hand motion and all this kind of stuff. It is one of those things, like, yeah, this is part of why I love Vincent D'Onofrio, is when he gets a role where he really gets the opportunity to just inhabit a person that's not him at all, is so drastically different. He gives his all to it, and it just becomes iconic. And I think that this performance is one of his iconic performances, that people remember the Edgar suit. Even if they don't know it's Vincent D'Onofrio, they remember this character if they've seen this, because you can't unsee it. It's just so coherent as a physical performance. And it is hilarious. It's fun to watch. And every time I see it, I just get joy at just how much he puts into this role. And apparently he did this by watching bug documentaries. So he actually researched for this role.
Given Vincent D'Onofrio, I'm not surprised that he would research for the role of playing a bug inside of a human suit. And he just has so much fun with it. Like when his truck is getting towed, he's so indignant. It's like...
Yeah, that's mine.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wow, you've culturated already.
It is really impressive. And Vincent D'Onofrio apparently did a lot of things for this role. So he like wore knee braces and he taped up his ankles to like force himself to have that real stiff walk motion. I'm sure he just had a blast. And apparently there's a thing in here about when they had to shoot the sugar water scene, but apparently they used real sugar water and they shot it like 15 times. And so he kept drinking glasses of sugar water. And apparently that's a lot of sugar.
That's a lot of sugar. You crash afterwards. Yeah.
I think that gets us to grades. Yeah. That
gives us to grades.
So, I mean, all I got to say is I love this film. I still love this film. I still sing the MIB song at the end by Will Smith. It's fantastic. And this film will always be one of my favorites. And that's why I'm giving it an A+.
I was coming in before, I was like, oh yeah, this will probably be an A- film, maybe. But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, the couple of scenes that I mentioned before that don't quite work kind of annoyed me a little bit, so I'm not going to be quite as effusive. I'm going to give it a solid A, which is more than I thought I was going to have. But it's like, yeah, I enjoyed it. It's like, this was a great way to spend this Sunday afternoon before recording this podcast, was to watch it. Like, that was time well spent. I can watch this again in some months and come back to it fresh and enjoyment, and maybe not have it so buried down so deep in the DVD pile. I think that's a good plan for me.
Yeah, totally worth it. If you ever need a bit of joy, I think Men in Black is one worth watching.
That's a great way to put a capper on this.
Absolutely. So with that in mind, we're going to be closing out now, and by doing so, I will point to Paul and say, Paul, tell folks where they can find you.
Probably Twitter is probably the most central way to find everything I do. I'm at Prince Justin, that's PRINCEJVSTIN, and from there you can find links to all the podcasts I do, my Patreon, all the book reviews I do across the internet, my photography. I am all over, or you can just visit my website, princejustin.com with a V instead of with a U, and just go to everything I do, because I like to say I'm ubiquitous in shadow, and it is true. Where can people find you?
They can find me at Sean Duke on Twitter. SeanDuke.net is my website, and I just started a Patreon myself, again, called The Joy Factory, which is patreon.com/TheJoyFactory. And if you want to follow the Skiffy and Fanti show, this is really easy to do. Paul, where are we on Twitter?
We are at Skiffy and Fanti.
What's our website?
Skiffyandfanti.com.
And where can folks get our newsletter?
Skiffyandfanti.com/newsletter.
And if you want to support us on the interwebs, where's our Patreon?
Patreon.com/Skiffy and Fanti.
And I think that's it. So on that note, I am going to go let my 7 million brothers and sisters know that dinner is on, but they are not allowed to come over for Thanksgiving. because even bugs can get coronavirus. So,
more you know.
Yeah. On that note, awkward ending and scene.
Stay frosty.
If you would like to support this podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. You can also find us on our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and on Twitter, at skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. The music for this episode comes from Sphere by Creo. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.